The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slodke for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Discover. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the May-June 2022 issue. We begin with our story, Living with Fire. 2 years after Australia's catastrophic black summer, the country is still recovering and trying to comprehend the deadly force of wildfire in the 21st century. It was Australia as few had seen it before. Apocalyptic images beamed around the world of Sydney's shimmering cityscape, enrobed in heavy smoke against a sci-fi orange sky. The harbor's soaring white opera house was silhouetted, sharply defined against dark clouds. For more than half a year, starting before July 2019 and lasting until March 2020, bushfires raged indiscriminately across the landscape, marching beyond the distant bush towards tidy suburbs and teeming subdivisions. They called it Black Summer. It was not just one fire or even hundreds. Australia was hit with 15,000 separate fires. Even in a country with centuries of bushfire history, which has built up psychological scar tissue against nature's flames, no one had ever seen a fire season like that, says Ben Shepherd, an inspector with the New South Wales Rural Fire Service in Sydney. Fires were so wild and erratic some days that they exceeded the worst-case scenario predictions of a sophisticated computer program used by the fire service. That was unheard of, he says. Everywhere in Southeast Australia, people were on the move, outrunning fire. Beaches, once places of recreation, were suddenly transformed into sites for evacuation. With nowhere else to run, families and children with their pets huddled together, prepared to jump into the surf to escape the flames. Finally, the Royal Australian Navy and Australian Army evacuated thousands from the sand with boats and helicopters. Overall, some 8,000 members of the Australian Defence Force took part in Operation Bushfire Assist over the course of Black Summer. In the aftermath, the international image of Australia as a land of endless beaches, magnificent coral reefs, and impermeable rainforests was as scorched as the landscape itself. The fire's toll, in all its forms, was staggering. More than 73,000 square miles burned, an area nearly three times as big as the Australian state of Tasmania. And in a stunning estimate that scientists say is conservative, around 3 billion animals died in and after the fires. Some species are expected to face extinction. Across the country, old-timers can tick off the names of historic deadly fires on their fingers like rosary beads, reciting the details from memory with a mixture of reverence and awe. But Australia's flammability has made a virtue of necessity. With 76,000 members, the New South Wales Rural Fire Service is the world's largest single body of volunteer firefighters. Few nations have studied wildfires like the Australians, whose settlement history is punctuated by devastating bushfires. Rather than cower before such a formidable enemy, Australia has endeavored to understand it. Over the years, scientists have painstakingly recreated major fires in tabletop exercises to analyze how people die in fire, how blazes consume homes, and how fire moves across a landscape. The sophisticated analysis has informed firefighting policies around the world. Driven by climate change's sobering reality, Australia and other countries that thought they understood fire are now learning to coexist with amped-up fires that come at them with increasing severity, duration, and frequency. Researchers had every intention of promptly studying and gleaning what they could from the 2019-2020 fires, but their work went the way of many COVID-era plans. It was put on hold while most Australian states enacted social distancing and closed their borders under a swift lockdown. The events that unfolded over the Black Summer were too consequential to wait for a break in the pandemic, though. The federal government convened a pandemic-modified Royal Commission, generally called only to investigate matters of acute public significance via public hearings. The scope of the inquiry was extensive, yielding scores of recommendations. Australian emergency responders need standardized training, improved weather forecasting, and updated models for bushfire predictions. An education campaign is needed to understand the fire alert system, which the public found to be confusing, inconsistent, and disorganized. And authorities must update the National Fire Danger Rating System to include a category for the new normal of mega fires. The report's conclusions could offer strategies for countries around the world where nations are facing their worst fire seasons ever. To that point, the United Nations in February released a first-of-its-kind landmark report that named a global wildfire crisis due to land use and climate changes. The findings, which involved more than 50 global experts, forecast a 30% increase of extreme fires by the end of 2050. But recent fire activity is already exceptional. In the U.S., the fire season is now 2, 3, or even 4 months longer than it used to be. California's 2020 wildfire season saw the worst burning in the state's recorded history, with 4.2 million acres burned and 33 deaths. The 2021 season scorched 3 million acres and killed 3 people, marking the state's second worst fire season for land impacted. Russia, too, had its most damaging fire season in the nation's modern history in 2021, with flames consuming forests across Siberia. Some of those smoldering fires in dense peat deposits are referred to as zombie fires, in part because of their ability to continue burning even in temperatures as low as 75 degrees below zero. One of the Australian Commission's findings could have resonance in the American West. The authorities called for a cleaner and more robust system for evacuating people caught behind fire lines, and a hard look at where and how Australians are building. The two issues are often connected. Fire professionals around the world speak in unison about the wrongheadedness of local policies that allow more and more people to build in fire-prone areas, making evacuations frequent and chaotic. This notion of building bans has seen pushback from U.S. officials, who are loath to prevent lucrative, taxable development in dangerous fire areas, even as they understand the jeopardy. And Americans have widely supported building restrictions in public surveys. The Royal Commission addressed this subject head-on, suggesting public officials should be required to consider present and future natural fire risk when making land use planning decisions for new developments. The Commission's prescriptions aren't so drastic, considering the devastation in the wake of Black Summer, 33 dead, including 9 firefighters, and 3,000 homes destroyed. In a blow to the country's agricultural sector, nearly 100,000 beehives suffered heat and stroke damage or were destroyed entirely. The health of rivers and lakes, watersheds and soils has also been compromised. All in all, there was damage to national parks, World Heritage sites, wetlands of international significance, threatened species, and even entire ecological communities. Australia's iconic wildlife are renowned, and for a reason. Most of them are found nowhere else in the wild. Some 80% of Australia's mammals are endemic, a unique signature of a continent that has been adrift for tens of millions of years. Plus about 90% of the reptiles and frogs and nearly half of Australia's birds exclusively call the continent home. So when images of singed koala bears and kangaroos running for their lives began flickering on screens across the globe, international concern for the plight of animals quickly made itself known. Messages and calls flooded into academic and scientific offices in Sydney and Melbourne, asking the same question: what becomes of the animals now that they have been burned out of their homes and their food sources have gone up in smoke? Wildlife specialists sounded alarms well before the fires broke out, arguing that the crisis for Australian wildlife was already critical, with a large number of species stressed by drought and profound climate change. In 2018, the federal government convened Senate hearings about the national faunal extinction crisis for animals found nowhere else on the planet. Professor Charles Dickman, an ecologist at the University of Sydney, calls Australia's endemic species the country's unique evolutionary cargo. Dickman became the go-to expert for journalists around the world trying to explain how the fires were fraying the nation's delicate environmental web. He told anyone with a microphone or pen that while telegenic teddy bear koalas died or lost habitat, so did snakes, bats, and rare spiders. It was not just the cute and cuddliest animals that we lost, he says. While the fires were burning in 2019, early estimates reported several hundred thousand animals dead. That quickly rose to several hundred million, and then a billion in January. The estimates ultimately reached nearly 3 billion animals with the publication of a Worldwide Fund for Nature commissioned report, led by wildlife researcher Lily Van Eeden and overseen by Dickman. Hordes of mammals, reptiles, birds, and frogs were killed or displaced, the report found. Wildlife experts could not think of another single event in modern times that had such a profound impact on a nation's animal species. What concerned the experts even more, Dickman says, was the inability to compile an accurate census. Some animals are simply difficult to find, even when you're trying hard to find them. Researchers made do with existing animal density estimates, but those covered only a portion of the species affected. There are few reliable estimates for platypus populations, for example. The COVID pandemic created its own limitations, turning field researchers into shut-ins, unable to tramp through the burned forests and grasslands, looking for what wildlife was lost and what remained. Dickman also says the scale of human and property loss understandably began to overshadow biodiversity destruction. Now, with time to reflect, scientists are considering the worst possible scenario for some Australian wildlife: extinction in the wild for a handful of species. I think it's quite possible that it will happen, Dickman says. He's concerned in particular about gray-headed flying foxes, two Kangaroo Island species of spiders with particularly unfriendly names, the trapdoor spider and the assassin spider, and potoroos, marsupials that excavate the ground for food. A relative of the kangaroo, potoroos, are known as an ecosystem engineer because when they dig around for a meal of fungi, their pawing aerates soils, allowing water to percolate into the ground. They were hard hit, Dickman says with an audible sigh. They depend on dense vegetation. So you lose your home and all the possessions in it, but then looters come in. In Australia, that's feral cats and foxes. These unchecked predators have been deemed the most significant force driving mammal extinctions in the country. The causes of the Black Summer fires are complex, but at the core, well understood. Already the world's driest inhabited continent, Australia is getting drier. 2019, the year the Black Summer fires began, was the hottest and driest year on record. And in southeast Australia, the heart of the bushfires, annual rainfall has decreased dramatically in recent years. Australia bears the brunt of climate change extremes like no other place. Harsh weather bakes with searing heat in some regions and inundates with torrential rain and flooding in others, often at the same time in different parts of the continent. While climate-driven extreme temperatures have been rendering the Great Central Core of Australia an ever more unlivable desert, more than 85% of the population lives in the coastal zone in the path of inexorable sea level rise. Research also suggests that fire behavior notably shifted in Australia after the 18th century, according to Jennifer R. Marlin, a research scientist at the Yale School of the Environment. Marlin's pioneering work in paleofire science uses sediment core samples to measure charcoal deposits. Contemporary readings taken in Australia show that whatever moderate fire cycle existed was radically altered with the arrival of Europeans, who burned and cleared land for settlement on an expansive scale. The findings underscore the inescapable relationship between nature, the land and water, and human behavior. Fire has existed for millions and millions of years, Marlin says. People have been using it for at least 300,000 years, and it has shaped the landscape of Australia and all the other continents. Now, with climate change hammering the country, bushfires are making a bad situation more difficult. Australia's 2020 State of the Climate Report included a grim, lengthy take on the shifting climate, with bleak statements rolling across the report like a film epilogue, compounding extreme weather and climate conditions. Record-breaking low rainfall coincided with extreme heat, severe drought, record-breaking heat waves, and fire weather. Andy Pittman, who heads the Australian Research Council's Centre of Excellence for Climate Extremes at the University of New South Wales in Sydney, says scientists are still getting their arms around the extreme weather patterns that bedeviled the country through Black Summer. "It was quite phenomenally dry, and we don't know why," he says. With unusually high temperatures and low humidity in early summer, the potential for a catastrophic fire season was foreseen. "We let people know early what we expected," says Shepherd of the New South Wales Rural Fire Service. "What was unexpected was the erratic and unpredictable fire behavior, with windborne embers carried more than 10 miles ahead of the blaze, setting off spot fires where they landed." Fire experts are still analyzing the creation of simultaneous pyrocumulonimbus clouds, or the fire-breathing dragon of clouds, as NASA has called them. These massive mushroom clouds that rise above large fires are capable of inhaling ash and smoke and injecting it into the stratosphere, literally, while producing a violent thunderstorm. Shepherd says Australia usually only sees these extreme fire clouds about once a season. He and Pittman agree that these massive convective formations have become more common. Crews also witnessed a vortex of whirling flames that spun fire and debris with tornado-force winds, a phenomenon that had been reported only once before in Australia. "A vortex filled a valley, picked up a fire truck, and put it on its head. It killed one of our men," Shepherd says. "I've never seen that kind of behavior." Similar fire vortices were spotted, rising multiple stories high in California's massive 2021 fire season, along with pyrocumulonimbus clouds. Researchers say fire-created weather is becoming more common in our era of megafires, when large fires burn towards each other and merge, covering hundreds of thousands of acres. If there's somebody caught between those two, they will experience the full force of what can happen in nature, says Andrew Sullivan, who leads the Bushfire Behavior and Risks Team at Australia's Federal Commonwealth Science and Industrial Research Organization. While nothing about the mechanics of fire behavior has changed, Sullivan says the extremes driving how fire naturally moves keeps ramping up, even as the landscape itself becomes more and more flammable. "What occurred during the Australian fire siege," he says, "was extraordinarily low moisture held in trees and grasses, creating an environment ripe for burning." "Fuel moisture content drives combustibility and the ease of ignition," Sullivan says. For context, Average moisture content in Australian plants at the peak of a summer day with fire danger is 5 to 7.5%, he says. As temperatures cool and humidity increases at night, moisture can rebound to 20 to 30%. That's when blazes die down, giving fire crews respite and a chance to clear vegetation to build lines around the fire. That usual cooling off often didn't happen throughout Black Summer. Research indicated that the fuels, grasses and trees, remain dry for longer periods. What we call oven dry, Sullivan adds, on those dry days, the fire behavior is going to be intense. It means that normal firefighting strategies cannot be employed without great risk. Sullivan noted another devastating blaze that lasted several weeks in February of 2009. Dubbed Black Saturday, the fast-moving erratic fires killed 173 people, fueled by shifting, raging winds. In 2020, Sullivan says, conditions were so hot and so dry for so long that one spark could create a fire that could go out of control. With climate change, we are likely to get more days like that. It's very much an active area of research. Climate scientists still puzzle over the precise mechanisms that created such severe fire danger. There were disruptions to La Nina and the Indian Ocean Dipole, ocean currents that influence Australia's weather. But what else, Pittman asks, contributed to the dryness? Something is going on. What is unambiguous is that fire seasons are appearing earlier in the year and lasting longer. It's also getting warmer. Scientists are often cautious about assigning exact causes to events as dynamic as wildfires, but a study in Nature last November definitively connects Australia's 800% increase in burned area in the last three decades to climate change. You won't find a climate scientist who would say there's no link between climate change and these fires, Pittman says. The challenge is to what degree. Even Australia's seen-it-all firefighters can't control weather or long-term climate shifts. Their adaptive response is now to stand down, let fire do what it does, and save who and what they can. They cannot fight those megafires, Pittman says. Here, there's an evolution, less about managing fires and more about managing evacuations. Turning lead into gold. The alchemist's goal of nuclear transmutation has been achieved, but not in the way they thought. Practitioners of alchemy, the medieval predecessor of chemistry, once had a saying, "It's harder to destroy gold than to make it." Gold, pure gold, is remarkably resilient against fire, acid, and rust. In fact, short of launching it into the sun or tossing it into a volcano, leaving the element in a nuclear reactor for a while is your only chance of near total destruction. Small wonder, then, that gold has so captured the human imagination. For centuries, alchemists from China, India, and Europe were obsessed with the transformation of base metals, particularly lead, into gold. They sought a mythical substance called the Philosopher's Stone to accomplish this task, with no success. Their techniques have long since been relegated to the realm of pseudoscience, alongside many of their other assumptions about the world. But the alchemists may have been onto something. They were indeed correct that lead could be turned into gold, even if they were dead wrong about how. Yet modern science routinely takes us far beyond the alchemists' wildest dreams. One of the most famous stories of nuclear transmutation comes from the 70s, when nuclear chemist and Nobel laureate Glenn Seaborg worked at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory alongside colleague Walt Loveland and then graduate student Dave Morsey. The scientists were using a super heavy ion linear accelerator to bombard atoms with ions as heavy as uranium at relativistic speeds. Among the ones we bombarded was lead-208, Loveland says. Accelerating the ions close to the speed of light allowed the scientists to study nuclear reaction mechanisms. We would measure the products, mostly concentrating on the yields, Loveland says. Some of those yields were gold. It was all relatively routine stuff. Then Seaborg said, "Hey, look at this. You're transforming lead into gold, doing the alchemist's dream reaction." He suggested that Morrissey write a paper on the research and present it at the upcoming American Chemical Society annual meeting in Miami. It did create a splash when I reported it at the meeting, but it's not particularly difficult or unique, Morrissey says. One can use various nuclear reactions to convert essentially any element into another nearby element. At the same time, however, it wasn't remotely cost-effective to make gold this way. It costs something like $5,000 an hour to run the accelerator, Loveland says, so they dropped it. This was far from the first time that humans had made gold, either on purpose or by accident. Matthew Nerzig, a media relations specialist at Berkeley Lab, explains that radioactive isotopes of gold were being made in particle accelerators for decades before Seaborg's experiment. The business of nuclear research is often the process of transformation, and sometimes creation. The heaviest 26 metals on the periodic table, for example, have only ever been observed in the lab, directly after some clever humans created them. In alchemy's heyday, there was hope and apprehension about its practical possibilities. After all, a nation that could turn common metals into gold could presumably make itself very rich, very easily. Isaac Newton, perhaps the most famous alchemist of all time, was reportedly anxious about public knowledge of alchemy and never wrote about it explicitly in his published writings. But while there are practical uses of nuclear medicine, both in creating weaponry and medicine, Loveland says the vast majority of the work nowadays is focused purely on better understanding the mechanisms of nuclear reactions. Newton, and the rest of us for that matter, can rest easy. A lunar mystery. Have you ever looked at the nighttime horizon and gasped at the sight of a spectacularly large moonrise? Typically, if you glance up at the sky hours later, the moon will seem to have shrunk. Dubbed the moon illusion, this phenomenon has been witnessed for thousands of years, a visual trickery that takes place all in the mind. And even after so long, scientists still disagree on what exactly is happening in our brains. To test it, you can snap a picture of the rising moon on the horizon and compare it to an image taken later that night. The size will remain consistent, even if your eyes deceive you in the moment. Similarly, during a supermoon, when the date of the full moon coincides with the point closest to Earth in the lunar orbit, and the moon appears roughly 7% bigger, the naked eye can barely see the increase, even if you can convince yourself otherwise. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slodke, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Discover is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again is area code 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.